Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us as he does every Thursday for open mic is Alex Beam. And normally at this time, Marjorie and I marvel at how appropriate it is that he's named Alex Beam. But here's the bad news. Our high school intern who writes those obsequious hyperbolic tributes is on vacation. So instead, we're letting Alex's writing speak for itself.
The leading citizens of southwestern Illinois could have imprisoned Joseph Smith. They could have chased him back across the Mississippi and delivered him to his old enemies in Missouri. Instead, they killed him. Why? That is the story of this book.
And that book would be American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church by Alex Beam, out in bookstores now with unbelievably spectacular reviews. Congratulations,
yeah.
Alex.
Chicago
Thank
Tribune,
you
LA Times.
Thank
you of course, all waiting with bated breath for the Boston Globe to weigh in,
exactly.
As well as the New York Times. Do you get any advance notice of when these reviews will be coming, Alex Beam?
No, is the short answer. The Wall Street Journal reviewed a couple days ago, which was agonizing because it has a paywall. I couldn't. Anyway,
Wait a minute. Don't tell me you didn't look at the review in the Wall Street Journal.
You had to spend $4 to read it.
Indeed, it did cost $4.
Did you pay it?
Absolutely not. What are you, nuts?
I read it to him.
Yeah.
You have to run to his neighbor's house out there. Would you live in Wellesley? A lot of people get in the Wall Street Journal out there. You could run to six or the neighbors and grab the paper.
Alex, how long did you take to write this thing before you tell us what it's about?
Two years.
Do you?
That's
when you're
not
writing,
bad at all.
Is there anxiety? I'm serious about this. Every time we have an author who's done a major work, and this is a major work, do you, as you're getting to the end, say, what if I spend 2 years of my life and people think this is poorly written, poorly researched? How much anxiety is there from the time you finish the thing till you start reading what the alleged experts have to say about it?
Well, I think the honest answer is only a modest amount of anxiety. I mean, I and my friends who are writers, I can't imagine undertaking a project that, I mean, let's rephrase that. I've been lucky enough to undertake projects that were really fun for me to do, that were really consuming and interesting. And so there, the calculus you have to tell to yourself is the book may fail. It's just a totally real possibility for any man or woman, the book may fail, but am I okay with how I spent these last 2 years? And if you can't answer that question yes, you're doing the wrong thing, absolutely. And to not answer a question that you didn't ask.
What is it?
The first time I could kind of breathe easily is like, you know, there's a moment when like, your wife, your cousin, your mom, her sister-in-law. There's a point at which, you know, somebody in the real world has got to read the book and pass judgment on it. And indeed, in publishing, there are things called pre-publication reviews. They're not written by your cousin. They're not written by your publicist. They're not written by your friend. They're written by some underpaid person. And, I got great pre-publication reviews. And second of all, Publishers Weekly, which is a really serious publication and really works hard, you know, liked the book. So that was kind of encouraging.
Tell us a story.
Come on, Alex. You know when something's good. You've been writing a column for a long time. You have a pretty good idea if it was good or not good, don't you?
Not with a book. You don't know how it's going to be received.
Well, I wouldn't know.
I don't mean to be a jerk, but you don't know how it's going to be received.
Okay. Well, it was received enormously well. So tell us this fascinating story, because I really didn't know much about the murder of the kind of creepy guy that started. Well, that's the way you portray him, as a creepy guy.
I don't believe I call him a creepy guy.
You didn't call him that, but you portrayed him that way. Tell us the story of the murder of the founder of the Mormon Church.
Well, Joseph Smith, yes.
Joseph Smith.
Who, for the record, was not a creepy guy.
He was not a creepy guy?
He was a prophet who spoke to God.
Okay.
And a true prophet for 5 million Americans. Joseph Smith was found himself and his 10,000 followers in southwestern Illinois on the banks of the Mississippi River. This was really their refuge of last resort. They'd been chased out of Ohio. They'd been chased out of Missouri. They were very, very successful missionaries. So that's why they had such a huge following in this oddly named town called Nauvoo. And to make my 280-page story short, they just frankly alienated everybody around them. This is the American frontier. And they alienated people for a variety of reasons. They voted in blocks, so they controlled all the politics of the county they were in and the counties around. That really got people angry. They were viewed as heretics. I mean, you have to be straight about that. The Book of Mormon, the notion that somebody had handed to him by an angel a third canonical Bible, in a relatively religious land, meaning the United States of the 1830s and 40s, is just way beyond the pale. That's an insane heresy. If he had been in England, he probably would have been burned, frankly. Thirdly, the polygamy was the word was out all across the nation. And I mean, from which means from the East Coast to the Mississippi River, as you know, newspapers printed and reprinted each other's stuff. He was known as sort of old Mormon Joe with his seraglio, you know, that he had a harem. I mean, somehow, even though polygamy was secret, and the fact that he had taken dozens of wives.
I didn't know that. Dozens of wives?
Well, there's my favorite footnote in my book. I can't find it. I have an actual footnote saying historians disagree as to the number of wives Joseph Smith. And then I quote three really prominent Mormon historians. One says 36, one says 52. Anyway.
Forgive me for calling it creepy. I found that creepy. I'm sorry.
It's in the Old Testament, of course. I mean, Solomon had 1,000 wives, I think. So, and he's one of the creators of the original Israel, I think. But
1,000?
I think it's in the Old Testament. It bears checking, perhaps. In any event, there's a chapter in my book called "Everybody Hates the Mormons." I mean, that's the situation they found themselves in 1844 in Illinois. Everybody hated them. They were also, I might add, economically, there's this word this guy called me out for. They were economically self-sufficient, although I can't be bothered to use the word autonomous or self-sufficient, so I describe them as economically autarkic. But in any case, Mormons even, you know, they would be the first incredibly insular culture and religion, as they were also at that time. So they were economically totally divorced from the country around them. Mormons did business with Mormons. They helped out other Mormons, and they did not help out non-Mormons. So that's, if you were counting, that's basically four reasons why everybody hated the Mormons. Everybody hated Joseph Smith. They had some relatively dubious reason for getting him inside a jail in Carthage, Illinois. And once they got him inside the jail, as many predicted, they simply lynched him. Although in this case, of course, they filled him full of bullets.
And the alleged perps were cleared after trial, correct?
Well, it's even sort of funnier than that if you have an incredibly dark sense of humor. I mean, he was murdered in broad daylight, you know, with hundreds of witnesses. And the kind of the thugs that actually killed Joseph Smith immediately kind of, you know, as Mark Twain would say, let out for the territory. They crossed the Mississippi River and disappeared into Missouri, which is just a locus centris for Mormon haters. So they put nine other people on trial, people who actually didn't kill Joseph Smith, but people just hated Mormons on principle. And there was this long, month-long trial, and they were all acquitted.
There was some, not to get too into the gruesome and to the details here, but he fell from a second-floor window. What was that about when he was killed? He started on the second floor and wound up outside?
Yes. I mean, I've been to the Carthage jailhouse. And, I mean, for the men and women who are listening who might be Mormons, I mean, they probably know every second of this story. But the so-called, you know, the mob invaded his jail cell, started firing at him, and there's a window there on the second floor, and Joseph was the only one who tried to climb out the window, although he was shot both from the door of his own jail cell, but simultaneously he was also shot from the ground.
Oh.
So he tumbles, some would say lifeless, is a huge dispute of whether he lost his life by the time he tumbled out of the... But the key thing is that before he tumbles out of the window, he says, Lord, is there no help for the widow's son, which is the Masonic call of distress. It's genuinely fascinating. He called out to the male Masons in the mob because a Mason cannot bear arms or harm another Mason. And a part of my book that is to be fair, a little bit complicated, but essential, was that Joseph Smith embraced Masonry, which, as you know, takes out ads on the radio right now, is very much alive in the United States. He embraced the ritual of Masonry in part to ingratiate himself with the kind of movers and shakers in Illinois. And it's incredible in a way that his last words were, Lord, have pity on, you know, have you no pity for the widow's son? But it's incredibly dramatic. I'm not a Mason. The Masons just kept shooting him. So that's how much they hated him.
And this is all pre-Utah for people who are saying, what does Illinois have to do with this? Obviously pre-Brigham Young and pre-Utah. You know, I haven't read it yet. I've read all the reviews. And I have to say, it is clearly not, which I think you'd agree, it's not an Irenic book. Would you agree with it? Now, the reason I say
Irenic.
That, whatever it is,
yeah.
Here's why I say this. I am reading one of the reviews a couple of days ago. This is in the Chicago Tribune that praises practically every word. However, in the middle, mirroring something that is occasionally said in the studio to Alex, I will read from the Chicago Tribune. Marjorie, While the prose is engaging, it does come with a quirk. Some of Beam's words, how do you say that word? Irenic?
Irenic.
Irenic, autarky, and they mention a few others, live outside the vocabulary of many readers. So you were true to yourself, is the bottom line.
To be fair, he goes on to say, he says two things. He says it's, you can understand those words in their context in the book. And secondly, he says, thanks for the vocab lesson.
Yeah. Hey, Alex, you say at some point this guy said, I'm paraphrasing, he, Joseph Smith, I guess I may be forced to be president of the United States. Now, his perception, was that perception anywhere near the reality of his power and influence and
well,
that
just
sort of
to put
thing?
That in context, I mean, there was a presidential election in 1844. Joseph Smith was nationally known celebrity, and he chose to run for president. I think it was utterly delusional. No, there's nothing to back that up. I mean, he did make comments in Nauvoo, Illinois. He said, I wouldn't be surprised if I'm the next president of the United States, and even then thought he might get elected 4 years later. I happen to think that's part of a manic delusion.
So contrast him to Brigham Young that replaced him, and I think many people think of, you know, Brigham Young University, and Brigham Young is always associated with the Mormon Church and stuff. What's the difference?
Well, I mean, to hype my book, which naturally pains me somewhat, I mean, what's interesting...
Can I interrupt you to say, by the way, if you're going to hype a book, the fact that you do not understand that you have to say the title... I'm serious. Every book
American
interview,
Crucifixion is
you
a
say
great
in
title.
My book, The American Crucifixion. You have to try doing that now.
Say, in my book, Better Living Through Yoga.
Go ahead, Alex. Yoga, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to help you out.
No, I understand that. Yeah, the book's called American Crucifixion. Anyway, I mean, I think one thing that's genuinely interesting about the book is that this is a genuine so-called hinge of history. It's a hinge of American history because it's only through the killing of Joseph Smith, that my favorite trite piece of writing from my own pen is that, you know, it's only because Joseph is killed that Brigham Young takes them in flatboats across the Mississippi River and, as I write, into the mainstream of American history. I mean, this is the galvanizing event. They realized they're going to kill us if we stay in the actual United States. So Brigham Young, who's, you know, incredibly dynamic leader, who's elected, so to speak. In fact, he is elected after Joseph is killed to be their new leader. He leads the Mormons westward to Utah, to the intermontane west, as I choose to call
it. Another of the words, yes. That means between mountains. I looked that up.
Go right. Yeah. I mean, it's a truly incredible story. And Joseph Smith had this idea even before his death. He said, we've just got to go somewhere where nobody's going to hate us. We got to go somewhere basically where there's nobody. I offer semi-sincere apologies to the Native Americans. There was an Aboriginal, you know, transient population in the Great Salt Lake. But in any case, they chose a really desolate, arid part of the United States, the Great Salt Lake Basin. And Brigham took them through unbelievable hardship, you know, took people from the Mississippi River across a series of mountains to present-day Utah.
What drew you to this story, Alex? Why'd you write this book?
Why did I write this book?
Yeah.
I was invited to write this book by an editor. I wanted to plug him. He's a graduate of Lexington High School named Benjamin Adams, a resident of Lexington, Massachusetts. He was an editor at Bloomsbury, a terrific publishing house. And he thought if we could get a trade book, a popular history, if we could get the right writer, this could be a great book.
Was there any? Do you have any interest in the subject matter before he approached you?
I did, to be honest.
Why?
I got to be really, really careful. The greatest name in Mormon history, in my opinion, is a woman named Fawn Brody, who's no longer living. And I knew her family in Los Angeles in 1979. She's Joseph Smith's first 20th century historian. She was excommunicated by her uncle, no less, from the Mormon Church for writing her astonishingly excellent biography of Joseph Smith called No Man Knows My History, which is still in print.
Wow, that's a great story.
It is a great story.
And how did, when she, after she was excommunicated, what happened? She
became Fawn Brody, a UCLA professor of history. I just can't stop myself. I'm so in love with Fawn Brody. She's the first American historian who ever linked Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings in her biography of Thomas Jefferson, obviously not with DNA, you know, using so-called historical methods. And at her death, unfortunately, when I knew the family, at her death in 1979, she was working on and published posthumously a book I haven't read and I doubt is all that good, but got a lot of attention. She published a so-called psychobiography of Richard Nixon.
Now, we're almost out of time here, Alex, so we can't go into
American Crucifixion.
American Crucifixion, we've talked about that, but you have a column in the Globe talking about how writers are going to be broke forever, but maybe that won't be true in your case.
Well, believe me, I'm sure... I did time that for the
arrival of this book.
For the arrival of this book, there really is no money in books, to quote my saint.
Yeah,
father.
Despite that fact, I hate to disclose something in a personal email between me and Alex, but I'm gonna do it anyway. When I say something nice to him about the reviews that I had read, he emails back something in typical Alex Beam fashion. At the end of which, he writes hashtag happy, and then hashtag. For once, which I think it sort of describes who you are. Yes, congratulations.
Thank you.
Would you like to
nice,
tell us
nice of both of you to take
before you go the names of any of the other books, or should we just keep those sub roads for the time being?
By Fawn Brody, by Alex Beam's American Crucifixion.
The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. It's called American Crucifixion by the great Alex Beam.
And Alex Beam is a columnist, of course, for the Boston Globe. Up next, TV's Bob Thompson of Syracuse University gives us his take on the latest on late night host Musical Chairs. And what happens when a Coen Brothers classic gets adapted to the small screen. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.